Today is Wednesday, September 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump's third national security advisor is out.
Things that would have embarrassed earlier administrations in terms of policy confusion are just another day of the week for this administration.
North Korea fires more missiles. And Taylor Swift's latest song, so painfully personal, she recruited friends to help her write it. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump's hawkish national security advisor, John Bolton, whom he had strong disagreements with on Iran, Afghanistan, and other places, was forced out on Monday. The sudden shakeup marked the latest departure of a prominent voice of dissent from the president's inner circle, as Trump has increasingly become more inclined to follow his own instincts instead of those advising him. It also comes at a trying moment for Trump on the world stage, just weeks ahead of the UN General Assembly, and as the president faces pressing decisions on difficult foreign policy issues. Tensions between Trump and Bolton and other advisors have flared in recent months over influence with the president and how to deal with some of the world's unsavory actors. Since joining the administration last spring, Bolton has been skeptical that the president's approach of North Korea and recently a vocal internal critic of potential talks between Trump and leaders of Iran and Afghanistan's Taliban. At the White House Tuesday, reporters asked Secretary of State Mike Pompeo about the latest administration departure.
I don't talk about the inner workings of how this all goes. We all give our candid opinions. There were many times Ambassador Bolton and I disagreed, that's to be sure. But that's true for lots of people with whom I interact. My mission set is always to make sure, as I run the Department of State, is to deliver America's diplomacy.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin also appeared with Pompeo and said the president's view on Iraq, North Korea, and Iran were just very different from Ambassador Bolton's.
I would say Secretary Pompeo and myself and the president are completely aligned on our maximum pressure campaign. I think, you know, we've done more sanctions on Iran than anybody, and it's absolutely working. Now, the president has made clear he's happy to take a meeting with no preconditions, but we are maintaining the maximum pressure campaign.
Well, joining us to discuss what this all means for U.S. national security is Jeremy Mayer, Associate Professor of George Mason University's Schar School of Government and Policy. Thank you for being with us. What is your reaction to the latest exit, the third national security advisor from the administration?
In one sense, this is normal. A president who disagrees with his own national security advisor deserves to have a new national security advisor. And Bolton was always a bad fit for Trump. Bolton comes from the neocon school of interventionism. He has been very interested in starting a war with Iran. He's a hardliner across a whole range of regions of the world, and Trump is not, at least to the extent that Trump has a consistent foreign policy, and I don't think there's much consistency. Back in 2015, he said the Iraq War was a disaster, a mistake, and he never was for it, and Bolton was one of the architects. Bolton really wanted to not have the Afghan War end the way that I think Trump and some people around him would like to see it end, a negotiated settlement where the Taliban are given a seat at the table. And that is where Trump has been heading all along. He wants to end the war in Afghanistan, and he wants to end it in a way that I think a lot of Republicans wouldn't be in favor of if Trump wasn't for it.
Why do you say that?
Well, Trump is very comfortable with taking non-traditional foreign policy views. It typified him in the Republican primaries of 2015 and 2016, and he's very much against long-term American engagements like the Afghan adventure.
Would you say that the president's decisions have garnered success?
I don't think there's a lot of success in the Trump foreign policy at this point. On the other hand, there's no great disaster. There's no Iraq war, right? I mean, nothing dragged George W. Bush's approval ratings down other than the failure to find WMDs in Iraq and the ongoing disaster that the Iraq War was after about the first 6 months. Trump doesn't have many foreign policy successes, that's true, but he also has avoided making terrible mistakes. I think that the North Korean engagement of Trump may well turn out to be a terrible mistake. I think the China trade war may well turn out to be a terrible mistake, and weakening NATO and undermining the Western alliance could well turn out to be the worst mistake of all, but none of those chickens have come home to roost yet.
And we've got Iran, the U.S. taking itself out of, or the administration pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, which we had heard by all indications they were complying, and now they're talking about ramping up their nuclear capability with all the other things you just mentioned, like North Korea and some of these other hot spots around the world. Without consistent leadership in the role that John Bolton was in, and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told reporters that nothing has changed as far as the administration's national security policies, but are we clear on what that means?
I don't think we are, because the Trump administration has been anything but coherent on foreign policy. The president has a few fairly consistent instincts, but in terms of policy stability, this has been a disaster. Over and over again, we don't know what we're going to do and when we're going to do it and if we're going to do it, even from something so important as how we're going to treat refugees from the Bahamas after that terrible hurricane. Some people in the Trump administration said they would be welcomed, and then the president reversed course in a matter of hours. Things that would have embarrassed earlier administrations in terms of policy confusion are just another day of the week for this administration.
Do you think, though, that the consistent inconsistency and departures within the administration in the realm of foreign policy and national security could draw some concern as far as some of these rogue governments like Iran and others that might seek to take advantage of it?
I don't know that they're going to do it because of the constant churn and musical chairs at the White House. I think it's more that they consider Trump to be so incoherent that they can get away with a lot of things they wouldn't have had on another president. I've long said that the level of turnover in this White House would scare you if it was Waffle House that we were being run. You wouldn't want to run a Waffle House with this level of turnover. And to run a White House with so many new people constantly churning through. It's also the case that Trump tends to pick people and then find out what everyone knew about them, right? When he picked John Bolton, everyone was like, why is he picking the single most Dick Cheney person in all of the Washington foreign policy establishment when Trump isn't like Dick Cheney on foreign policy? So this was a divorce that was destined. And the only surprise to me is how long Bolton managed to go without having an ideological clash with Trump.
Well, despite their differences, it does seem to be somewhat of a pattern that the president likes people who work for him to agree with him. Do you think that that is a detriment?
Oh, I absolutely think that a president who can't have strong disagreement from his advisors is a weaker president than one who can tolerate it. At the same time, Bolton is a legend for leaking in this town because he knows the policy process. He knows how to kill an idea with kindness or neglect. He knows how to kill a concept by leaking it and who to leak it to. So if you're looking for loyalty, which, you know, all presidents do, but Trump does to an extraordinary degree, I think Bolton's days were numbered from the get-go.
All right, that is Jeremy Mayer, Associate Professor at George Mason University's Schar School of Government and Policy. North Korea has offered to resume stalled nuclear talks with the United States, but it has also conducted another apparent missile test Tuesday. The move suggests Pyongyang is not likely to give up its pressure campaign anytime soon. We have more details now from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Hours after offering to sit face-to-face with U.S. officials, North Korea launched its 10th round of weapons since May. South Korea's military says the two projectiles traveled 330 kilometers, another short-range test. The tests appear designed to increase leverage ahead of nuclear talks, if those talks ever take place. Late Monday, senior North Korean diplomat Choi Sun-hee said Pyongyang was willing to sit down with U.S. officials in late September. But she warned the United States must present a new calculation method or risk ending the talks altogether. Even if talks did occur, Seoul-based political analyst June Park says it's not clear either side has softened their stance.
What will come out of the meeting is still under question, because Choi Soon-hee has been noted as saying she expects to see a different kind of calculation method. And I'm not quite sure whether the U.S. is ready to present something like that.
Talks have been stalled since a second summit in February between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ended abruptly without a deal. Trump rejected Kim's demand for sanctions relief in return for partial denuclearization. Kim agreed in June to resume working-level talks, but North Korean officials have not shown up. North Korea has given the United States an end-of-the-year deadline to change its approach, but Park says it's not clear how firm that deadline is.
At this point, under their statement, it sounds very firm, but if ever there is a meeting held, let's say, during the fall, and they are working towards some kind of an agreement, you need time to work on it, I think it could be a flexible date.
Trump has not responded to the latest launch. The U.S. president has said he has no problem with North Korea's other short-range launches. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Dorian's Bahamas death toll is now at 50, but many people are still missing. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announces plans to annex part of occupied West Bank if he is reelected. A drone strike reportedly sets off blasts at an Iraqi Shiite militia weapons depot. And first love, then marriage, but more U.S. couples are skipping the baby carriage. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The recent surge of deadly xenophobic attacks in South Africa is triggering concern in several African countries. In Nigeria, the deaths have sparked reprisal attacks and calls for an end to the operation of South African businesses in the country. But as Timothy Obaizu reports from Abuja, tens of thousands of Nigerian jobs could be at stake.
It's not business as usual for Moses Iyuagba. Days after reprisal attacks on South African-owned businesses in the Nigerian capital, his corner shop business near Abuja has been spared. But Iyuagba says he's still worried after angry protesters raided the offices of South African communications giant MTN and its affiliate ShopRite, halting operations.
It's like 4 days I've not been in their office before, but presently as I'm speaking with you people, my stock is going down.
This is not the first time xenophobic attacks on Nigerian nationals in South Africa have triggered reprisals. Similar incidents happened after attacks in South Africa killed 62 people in 2008 and 7 more in 2015. Hundreds of protesters took to the streets after recent attacks killed at least 5 people last week. One of them, Ali Yusuf, accuses the South African government of not addressing the issue. Yusuf asks, why can't South Africans leave Nigerians in their country to go about their businesses? We have made Nigeria comfortable for them. We're not disturbing them. We're not burning down their houses or businesses. South Africa is a major destination for economic migrants across Africa, including Nigerians. But foreign workers often face anti-immigrant violence for competing against locals for jobs, usually in low-skilled sectors. South Africa's High Commissioner, Bobby Morrow, was summoned by authorities here. He has condemned the attacks.
Over the past 25 years or so, we have been through a number of challenges. And what has always come to our rescue is this strong bond of friendship and kinship between the two governments of South Africa and Nigeria. So our government condemns by all means acts of violence against any individual.
South Africa's huge investments provide employment and livelihoods for several thousand Nigerians. Nigeria's Foreign Affairs Minister Geoffrey Onyama says the government is consulting with its South African counterparts to address the issue.
We feel, the Nigerian government, that very definitive measures have to be taken to stop once and for all these acts of aggression and criminality against Nigerians in South Africa.
Many Nigerians, however, continue to demand an end to South African operations in the country. For now, major South African businesses in Nigeria are shut down indefinitely, while people like Iyuagba, whose jobs depend on them, wait for a return to business as usual. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, there has been a tremendous amount of talk over border security here in the United States and more around the world as the number of migrants and refugees continues to rise. But the idea of borders is something that is human-created, as we hear from our next guest, Atusa Abrahamian, senior editor of The Nation magazine, who just spent 2 weeks sailing around Svalbard, Norway, one of the few places in the world with open borders. And it's also the subject of her new story, No Man's Land, A Century of Open Borders in the Arctic. Thank you for being with us. This really is a very thought-provoking story. How did it all come about?
So I've been writing about borders and citizenship and migration for some time now, and Svalbard was one of the places that I always knew existed, but I didn't think that it was really a place that people went. I assumed it would just be a kind of a research center like Antarctica, really remote, not much going on, probably not very interesting to see. And I don't really like the cold, so I never really made an effort to go. And then, you know, we've been hearing so much about climate change, and borders and open borders have been in the news a lot lately. People are calling for opening up borders, closing borders, depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on. And it occurred to me that Svalbard is, you know, at the nexus of both of these conversations. It's a place that's warming much faster than the rest of the planet, 2 to 3 times faster because it's so far north. People there see the effects of climate change directly every day, has a real impact on their lives. But it's also a place that has had open borders for as long as it's been discovered, and informally forever, and formally since 1920, which is when a treaty was signed, actually after World War One, the Svalbard Treaty was signed, and in the process of giving Norway responsibility for governing Svalbard, the international community also said, well, you have to let everyone who wants to live there live there. And it's been that way ever since, which I think is remarkable.
Does it work to have just this open border and anybody can show up and it's just sort of like just something completely different from any place on the planet?
Norway, it won't surprise you to hear, has found ways to make sure that tons and tons of people don't show up. One of them is a rather organic way. It's cold up there. It's remote. Half the year is pitch dark. The other half is totally bright. It's not a place where everyone would want to live or even visit. So the natural environment is a deterrent for, I would say, the vast majority of people. It's also a very expensive place to live. And the stipulation with the open borders arrangement that Svalbard has is that it doesn't matter where you're from, you can roll in and live there, but you have to be able to support yourself. So you can't go there and rely on the government for housing or for food. You have to have a job and the means to support yourself. And since it is expensive, everything there is imported. There isn't a whole ton of agriculture in the Arctic. It can get quite pricey. I would compare it to New York prices, and it's pretty expensive here too.
Right, but not like the the rest of Europe where you have free health care and stuff like that.
Exactly. Svalbard is part of Norway, but it does not have the same social welfare benefits as the rest of Norway.
You talked about climate change. You talked about more and more people traveling there, at least maybe not permanently because it's a place where there are open borders, but just to sort of bear witness of a place that is really seeing the impacts of climate. And sadly, your description, just glaciers calving as though they were losing teeth, shorelines receding. It's difficult. And of course, polar bears, which could potentially be gone. What is tourism doing to this area?
Tourism is booming in the Arctic. And part of the reason is that soon we're not going to be able to see these beautiful glaciers and these adorable animals and these amazing scenes of ice and snow and endless blue stretching into the horizon. The issue immediately is it's not very well regulated. Tour guides don't have any real certification process, and so you can have people who are incredibly diligent and take a lot of care to respect wildlife. You can just as easily have a bunch of people who don't know what they're doing trampling through and ruining the environment in various ways. An example of what we saw when I was there, we stopped in this really gorgeous place, probably the most beautiful place I've ever seen, and we got out of the boat and it was stunning, and then we looked down and it was just covered in trash. And part of the reason was the currents were kind of routing the trash in that direction. But trash has to come from somewhere, and it's coming from ship. People are throwing things off deck. People are dumping their garbage. You can see it, especially when everything is white and blue, and then you have a pink soda can or a TV that washes up. It's very, very noticeable.
The way you put it was also really poignant, I thought. The refuse of humanity, as you describe so clearly, when you see things that you just don't expect to see in the Arctic.
I think on a macro level, the bigger carbon emissions picture and the bigger plastic waste issue is immediately much more significant than garbage that's washing up, because the bigger picture is what affects all of us, and that's the whole planetary ecosystem that's being disrupted. But certainly, day to day, people who live in Svalbard are livid about this. It's a very isolated place, but you see the worst of everything because it's so isolated. It all winds up there.
When we talk about borders, we see around the world more and more countries are becoming unwelcoming. We know that Africa is going to have more and more people leaving because of the climate, many places becoming uninhabitable or very difficult. But what you said, all these borders that we have on this planet, it's just a human invention. This planet was here before humans, and we are the ones that drew all these lines, but they really have nothing to do with
us.
Yeah.
The feeling you get when you're there, when you're thinking, as I do, about borders a lot, it's that we actually don't control much of what goes on up there. We can ruin it. We're ruining it every day. But the wind changes direction, and you're sailing in the Arctic. Like, what are you going to do? You've only got so many choices. And the decisions that you make and the plans that you have and the, you know, where you draw lines and borders and all of these human constructs actually doesn't make a shred of difference if there's a storm or if there is a big thaw or a big freeze. You can't really go anywhere. You can't really do anything if nature isn't cooperating. And we don't control that. There was one moment that didn't make it into the story, unfortunately, but we made it up fairly far north in our sailboat. And then we couldn't go any further north because the ice was too dense and we couldn't move. But we did get out of the bigger boat and get into these little zodiacs, and we scooted around and looked at the ice. And we saw a walrus that was sitting on a piece of ice. And we were with a guide, and one of my colleagues on this trip said, well, how close can we get to the walrus? Like, can we see it up close? Can we take a picture? And they really wanted to know, like, well, what's the limit? What's the limit? And the guide said something that I thought was so profound. She said, well, it's not really about how many meters, because who knows? Like, it can totally depend. The important thing is how you approach it so as not to disturb the animal. And I thought that was such a nice encapsulation of the way it feels to be up there with nature, that it kind of is arbitrary. You realize how arbitrary it is to draw lines. And you think much more about the sort of ethical and moral dimension of how we interact with nature and each other, ultimately.
Because borders are such a big issue now, we hear in America, this president wants, you know, a wall to block people out. And like you said, all of these borders and these lines that we've drawn are just man-made. They're not something that this planet came with. So what is your overall takeaway about your experience there when it comes to border issues there and really around the world?
I don't know that I would endorse the system that Svalbard has, because even though it's open, it's not very egalitarian. Not everyone can make a living high enough to live there. I think that it shows us that another way is possible, and maybe that other way isn't the ideal way, but it does suggest that we need to think a little bit more creatively about what borders are, who decides where they are, and what they look like, because this very fixed idea from that we have now is going to blow up in our faces. And in keeping with this idea that borders are not part of the natural world, once nature catches up with us, with global warming and all of this destructive environmental change, we're going to have to start thinking about this in a serious way. And I think Svalbard is a starting point, if not the end point.
All right. That is Tusa Abrahamian, senior editor of The Nation magazine, talking about her new story and her adventure in Svalbard, Norway. And her new story is called No Man's Land, A Century of Open Borders in the Arctic.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recent study led by Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory provides evidence that a huge freshwater aquifer lies beneath the Atlantic Ocean just off the northeast coast of the United States. The study, published in the journal Nature Scientific Reports, suggests that the mostly freshwater supply is being held in porous sediments that lie below the ocean. The study authors say that the aquifer appears to be the largest found in the world so far, and that it extends about 80 kilometers from shore in Massachusetts down to at least New Jersey. The study suggests that the fresh water was fed to the aquifer from melting glacial ice about 15,000 to 20,000 years ago. The researchers noted that if the aquifer were found on the surface, it would create a lake covering some 39,000 square kilometers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Taylor Swift has collaborated with fellow artists on an emotionally revealing and very personal new song. Swift's Soon You'll Get Better, a song that is an emotional tribute to her mother, who's battling cancer for a second time, reveals what a painful and terrifying experience it's been for the singer. The subject is so personal that Swift had to ask her friends and fellow musicians, the Dixie Chicks, to help her put it all together. It's resulted in a moving piece of work that is likely to be very relatable to many people struggling to deal with a loved one facing a life-threatening illness. Details of Andrea Swift, the singer's 61-year-old mother's illness, have been kept private, but Swift's heartbreak is abundantly clear. Been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. I know I'll never get. There's not a thing that I won't try.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown.